welcome to sit there, Matt. Welcome to sit here.
Yes, I'll rotate around here.
Not seeing. Al, should we get this going?
Yeah. Paul, whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Yeah, so I'm gonna call this ad hoc meeting to order. And I guess we have a speaker.
Howdy.
How are you? I'm Fred.
Hey, Fred.
I'm on city council.
Nice to meet you.
Fred is one of two city council committee members. Unfortunately, Al is sick, had to go to the hospital. So I couldn't make it, and then we've got members of the public here who are very interested.
With an RBG shirt, I can tell.
Yeah.
Very good.
Gail Marshall, a former county supervisor and local resident. Lisa is Fred's partner. Gabby is all the community member.
Great.
And I think both Gail and Gabby are friends of the library.
I'm not.
Yeah,
well, quite as well.
Yeah. Not
she's
as
my
well.
Secret weapon.
And Lisa is on the board for the fire.
Oh, okay.
Someone
is
he
on the board?
Yeah.
Are you having to do the same thing? Or were you already in district?
Mm-hmm. We're a special district, so I.
They're all getting it soon, right?
That's
now.
That's
going to
happen.
Yeah. You haven't gotten a letter or anything?
Nope.
Not yet.
Pay attention to the presentation.
Coming under the radar.
Actually talked to an attorney who said they were going alphabetically through the special districts.
Oh, geez.
So. Thanks for having me here. My name is Paul Mitchell. I'm a demographer, and I also am the vice president of a company called Political Data, which is a bipartisan voter data firm. So I work in voter data, and I work in redistricting and demographics. I'm going to go through a presentation that is, actually, I've got a little statistics, but we'll talk about the California Voting Rights Act. Some terminology stuff, because a lot of times people conflate words and terms, and even I do, so I want to make sure we all are saying the same things. Talk a little bit about traditionally how redistricting is done properly, and even I have a slide in here about a law that will be taking effect in January based on the governor's signature of a bill last week that changes the rules for us, kind of midstream. And then look at some population numbers for the city, and then show you some examples of mapping that can be kind of instructive when we get into a process of districting and give an idea of kind of the things that we'll be thinking about. So, first off,
maybe before you go, Paul, because I know you understand it'll be a part of your talk, but just make sure you confirm this. Coming out of the last meeting, there was a real interest in kind of a pre-public outreach process to get members of the community involved before we get to the formal part of map making or looking at options. And so maybe you could be sure to touch on that and what options are available to us and that sort of thing. And I know I saw this, which thank you very much.
Yeah.
I think maybe you're part of that conversation.
Great. Yeah, I'll discuss that for sure. So the California Voting Rights Act is a law that was actually written back in 2001, so it's been around for a long time. But it has taken a long time for cities and school boards to kind of transition to districted elections under the California Voting Rights Act. And one reason why that's taken so long is that when it was first passed, there was a lot of confusion as to what it really meant. It took almost a decade of lawsuits and court decisions to really kind of like hone in on who is covered under the California Voting Rights Act, and it turns out that basically everybody is. The California Voting Rights Act essentially eliminates at-large elections, those elections where it's like vote for two or vote for three in like an entire jurisdiction, and it favors by-district elections where each district elects the one person from their district. So it defines at-large elections as any election where there isn't that single-member district. It also defines a term for racially polarized voting, which essentially says, kind of in the layperson way, you can't have at-large elections if you have a population where different people vote differently, and it can be tied kind of statistically to their ethnicity or their protected class. So if it was a group of Chaldeans or a group of Armenians or a group of Latinos or Asians that was voting in a different way, then that is what triggers you to have to go to district elections. In federal law, they use this term majority-minority, which says, really, that you have to go to district elections under federal law if you can create a district that's 50% of one protected class. Now, as we'll discuss, you're not able to do that here, at least probably not. However, the state law liberalized that and said you have to convert to districts if you have an ethnicity that could influence the outcome of an election. There's no number value associated with that. It's kind of left up to interpretation. In some cases, we've seen it be as low as like 17% of one ethnicity is enough to influence the outcome based on how courts have perceived it. The law does allow kind of an escape valve from being sued and having to pay millions of dollars in plaintiff fees. Santa Monica right now has racked up $12 million and they've paid to the plaintiffs in a lawsuit like this. And that is to undergo a process with kind of this prescribed structure that I'll talk about to convert to districted system. And once you're in a districted system, the CVRA ignores you. One thing about this, since we're kind of informal, that I like to talk about sometimes, is that in California, at-large election systems were the reform in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Because when California cities and local agencies were forming, they looked back east and saw ward bosses and political patronage and scandals associated with districts that were so small in some communities that like one guy and his cousin and his brother could like band together and control precincts and use that to kind of like corrupt elections. And so they said if we have large elections, there won't be any possibility that some small group will be able to control just one corner of the city. The flip side was that now, 100 years later, we have this kind of pocketing of ethnic populations around the state that, for that same reason, they don't have the power to elect candidates that they're choosing because of the dilution of their votes in that at-large election system. So it's kind of funny how 100 years later, what was a reform is now being re-reformed back the other way. So the districts that would be created under this law have essentially one function. It's to elect people. You can think of these district lines as only being operative 1 month every 2 years. And that's the month that ballots go out and voting happens. And after the election's over, then the lines really don't matter for anything. I've seen city councils that have gone to this districted system, they still keep the interests of the whole community as their charge. I've seen others, like the city of Sacramento, where, and this frustrates me, but when you walk into the city council member's office, on their door it lists what neighborhoods they have, as if like that's the neighborhoods they care about. And the culture of the board is really going to be determined by how they work, you know, after they're elected. But it's not meant to say that this system is going to force that kind of like fiefdoms or kind of like it has to impact the way you govern. Redistricting is the process of redoing the districting. And I'll slip up all the time and call what we're doing redistricting because it's kind of the terminology we normally use, but redistricting more technically is what you'll do next time, which is, you know, in 31, you'll redraw lines based on population changes over the last 10 years. The gerrymander is based on this political cartoon from Governor Gary. So if you want to be a redistricting snob, you call it a gerrymander. And it was a, you know, dragon salamander kind of looking thing that was a state legislative district line that he created, and you know, for his political advantage, and a cartoonist for the local paper drew this political cartoon, showing the different counties and how they all were formed together to make this gerrymander. And people think like this is a long time ago, this stuff never happens anymore. But in 2001, the last time the legislature drew lines, that was Senate District 21, which to me looks like it looks just like the gerrymander. It's got wings and feet and everything like that. So gerrymandering still happens, but it's oftentimes not what people think of it. This is how gerrymandering works. Gerrymandering works when it takes an area like this. You've got yellow triangles and green triangles, where yellow triangles have the majority of the population, let's say. And if you were just to say, draw me districts, because we got to go quick, what are you going to draw? Almost everybody would draw something like that. And in that situation, yellow triangles would be able to elect candidates of their choice in two districts, and the green triangles would be able to elect candidates of their choice in one district. Now, if Team Green took a little look at it and said, well, wait, what if I draw it to our advantage, and we drew that? That is a way to kind of take your minority power and try to, you know, change the potential outcome of an election using this. And what we're going to do is work to try to make sure there isn't a gerrymander by following certain kind of traditional redistricting principles. These redistricting principles come from a variety of different sources, state law, federal law, case law, meaning laws that are kind of created out of court decisions, and, you know, best practices if you went to the Common Cause website, or, you know, if you were looking at university research of things that can be done in redistricting to try to maintain kind of this fair mapping process. The first step is districts have to be equal size. And when we say equal size, we're saying based on residents from the most recent decennial census. So it's the total population, kids, citizens, non-citizens, people in the hospital, somebody sleeping in the outdoors, like it's just people. There have been a lot of Supreme Court cases on this, even recently, last year, where, you know, Texas wanted to draw their legislative districts based only on eligible voters or on registered voters, and that's been prohibited. It has to be based on a whole person count. Districts have to be contiguous, meaning they have to be whole parts. Now, the whole part discussion can take a couple of spin-offs. You think of whole part, it makes sense, you know, it's going to be a whole thing. It's not going to be like a pocket over here and a pocket over there. I actually saw a water district in LA that did that. Like, there was like a district A, and then B, and then the rest of A. So that's not legal. However, there's two things to think about. I don't think this comes up in this city, but what if you had an island, right? An island isn't necessarily contiguous to the mainland, but like if you're looking at Catalina Island, there are two ferries that go to Catalina Island, so when they're doing state redistricting, they say, well, we have to make sure that Catalina Island is joined to the mainland via one of those ferry routes. Another issue that comes up in contiguous, which might come up in this redistricting, is the idea of something being functionally contiguous. So right now I'm doing districting in the city of Davis. If you happen to by chance to know the city of Davis, there's a train track going right through separating kind of central Davis and south Davis. And you literally can't cross the train track except in a couple different parts at the two ends of the city. So if I was to draw a district that went right through the middle, like a column, it would mean that the people in South Davis would literally have to drive out of their district around to the end where they can get past the railroad tracks and then back through another district to get to the other end of their district. So from a satellite map, it looks like it's contiguous, but from a functional standpoint, it's not. So that's the other thing that might come up, is that something has to be both contiguous from like outer space and also functionally contiguous, and that can take on a lot of different meaning. Maintaining communities of interest. At the heart of a lot of our redistricting law is what's happened in the Deep South. So, and that's where you see a lot of the court decisions done, and in fact, you'll be redistricting in an area that, you know, most of its residents couldn't tell you the history of Selma, but their lines are being drawn based on a lot of the case law that came out of places like Selma. And communities of interest is one of these, and that is when they were doing districting in the South, oftentimes what they would do is one of two things. They would first off identify the community they were trying to redistrict around, usually it was African-American community, and they would do one of two things. They would either identify it and draw it all in one district, pack it all in one district, and say, congratulations, you get one member of Congress. Or they would crack it and draw districts like pizza slices, and it's like, hey, every member of Congress now has to care about African-American population because you're all 6% African-American, in which essentially dilutes their vote and disenfranchises them. So in our discussions, communities of interest will primarily, the highest tier community of interest will be those protected classes. Latinos, Asians, African Americans, and any other kind of protected classes that could be identified. I'm not aware of them, but like I mentioned earlier, you know, in North San Diego, the Chaldean population is a community of interest. Most people don't even know what a Chaldean is. It's a Iraqi Catholic. And there's a dense community of them in like El Centro in northern San Diego, or you know, you could, like, I grew up in Glendale, Armenians. But these are the general ones that you see, and the idea is to identify where those populations are and make sure that none of the line drawing is doing something to disenfranchise them, either by packing them or cracking them. The second kind of community of interest is more, has more nuance, it requires more kind of like hearing from the public, it requires kind of like a knowing of the area, and that is identifying communities of interest based on kind of like how people view their community. And so it might be people who live on the coast, or people who live inland, people who live in the mountains, people who live in the urban area, people who live near a campus, people who live in a senior community, people who have a number of different kind of attributes. And what's almost most important is when those attributes intersect with the government that's being districted. So if I'm doing a fire district, I did a fire district, and one of the things they were looking at is, what are the fire stations? In a city redistricting or school board redistricting, nobody really cares where the fire stations are, because that's not how the school district or the city council interact with their population. But a school district might care about where the elementary and junior high and high schools are, and a city might care about where the city facilities are or whatever programs it is, you know, really working on and where those lay out. So communities of interest can be different for different agencies, and it is more of an art form than a science. Following local government lines, this comes up less in cities, more in like drawing counties or something where you wouldn't want to split cities, or drawing a high school district where you might not want to split the junior high or elementary school districts underneath it, or the cities underneath it. So oftentimes when we draw districts, you'll see some really squiggly weird line in a congressional plan, and to an outside observer, they're like, that's a gerrymander. And then somebody who actually knows the area says, oh no, that's the external boundary of Pleasanton, you know? So trying to maintain those, even if they're awkwardly shaped governmental lines, can be a kind of good redistricting practice. And then finally, keeping districts compact. And this is compact meaning squares and circles, not compact meaning small. You know, when I redistricted Yuba County, it was like there was a district that was just massive, but it was as compact in shape as it could be. So compactness isn't meant to mean square feet or something, or square miles. It's meant to mean kind of the shape. And there's a whole bunch of, there's a whole like subpart of academic research on this idea of compactness. Now the new criteria for 2020, which we'll be hitting because this process is going to overlap the implementation of the new law, adds some other things to this. One is the state should be supplementing the federal redistricting data set with information on where prisoners came from before they were arrested. The issue is that when you do redistricting and you have a prison there, the prison population in 2001 would be counted into that city's population. And so even if there's 20,000 prisoners in a city of 100,000 people, now each district's going to be 20,000 people, but that prison has to go into one geographic area or whatever, and so you end up having one district that's half as many people as the other districts because of the prison population isn't voting but is being counted. Now what they're doing in the state laws, they're going to work on redistributing prisoners back to either where they were living before or where they were arrested, and saying that's where the person lives now for the purposes of redistricting. So presumably, we don't know what this will look like, but the Department of Corrections and the state should be providing us kind of an addendum to our data set to say, here's a little peppering of where you need to reallocate prisoner population for that determination of equal population. Unknown how that's really going to work, but that's out there. It also says that communities of interest cannot be defined as a relationship with a political party, incumbents, or candidates. Now, this is a weird wording, because it doesn't say you can't consider incumbents. But it does say that they're not a community of interest. And I don't, nobody really is kind of clear on what that means. Traditionally, you can include incumbents within a redistricting process for a couple of reasons. One is that the voters have already expressed an interest in this candidate, so undoing that voter's interest in the candidate for kind of a redistricting purposes doesn't necessarily make sense. The second thing is that courts oftentimes don't want to see redistricting weaponized, where the body, the elected body, has one council member they can't stand, so they redistrict to gerrymander them out of the city council and call it like, oh, we weren't really, like, we just didn't want to preserve incumbents. So most people in my position kind of take a in-between viewpoint, and that is I generally start a redistricting process not considering where incumbents live unless the board asks me to affirmatively. I don't go look them up myself. And if through the redistricting process there can be a discussion of where incumbents live and how lines could be just like just a little bit, not to violate those other redistricting criteria, to allow all the incumbents to have a seat, that's great. But if, you know, like I had a redistricting in San Bernardino County where two incumbents lived like in neighboring census blocks and another incumbent lived like, you know, over a fence from them, then it was like, you know, yeah, I'm not going to draw the pizza slice kind of version of redistricting just to keep incumbents in. So that's, it's going to be interesting to see how attorneys define that second point, whether or not we can actually talk about incumbents or whatever, but it definitely says they can't be community of interest, which is kind of a weird way of saying it. But it does then later on expressly prohibit the cities from drawing districts for partisan purposes. So that speaks to me that maybe if they really, really wanted to prohibit incumbents, they would add a second line that says prohibiting incumbents, because they felt like they needed to create the second line for prohibiting you know, partisan redistricting in city councils. I've only seen partisan redistricting in city councils once, or twice, LA and San Diego. Most redistricting is about like the urban versus the hillside versus the, you know, that kind of stuff. And then it prohibits mid-decade redistricting. And this happens every once in a while where like City of Sacramento did their redistricting, and then the guy who wanted this one part of his district and fought for it in the redistricting, he ran in for the state legislature and left the city council, and as soon as he was gone, the council said, oh, we're gonna go and we're gonna fix that because we didn't like it ever. So it'll ban that from happening. The only instance in which an agency can redistrict mid-decade will be as if they add population, like if the fire district annexed another fire district, something like that.
Can I ask a quick question? How are the homeless accounted for?
They are accounted for in the decennial census. So they are part of the population.
Yeah, okay.
So, and we're working with the state on doing some of the data work behind how they're counting the population. And what they will do is they will identify either like a street corner that the person can get assigned to or just like a latitude, longitude.
Yeah, because they can vote with that same.
They can vote that same way too. Yeah, when you register
your
vote, you
corner.
Can write like,
yeah.
This is where I am.
Yeah,
because
when you do precinct walking, you found that.
Yeah.
Like somebody had that passed
there. Yeah, sure.
So
the city population based on the 2010 census is 13,040. I'm presuming Department of Finance figures have it higher than that right now, based on what I'm seeing in the data. But right now we just deal with the census data. So if we were to look at districts in five districts, then the median district population would be 2,608. That is a small district. It also means that if we want to have equal population, in most cities it shouldn't be more than a 10% deviation, meaning the largest district should be no more than 10% larger than the smallest district. You can also think of it kind of as a rough number, 5% over, 5% below. So 5% of 2608 is 130. So you're thinking roughly you're not going to see any districts more than 2738 and no districts less than, you know, 2570 or 2470. So that's kind of the size we're looking at. That's a pretty narrow, fine number.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you're assuming five districts. I was assuming in my mind that it's possible to have four districts and an at-large mayor. Is that not a...
So the law allows you to go up to seven districts or nine districts, but generally doesn't allow you to go back down to.
No, couldn't go to four.
You have to talk to attorney about that. And there are two things that would jump out at me. One is, I believe the law allows you to go to 7 or 9. I don't know that it allows you to go back to a smaller number, because you do have 5 elected right now, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think, there are cities that are at 4 and an elected mayor, like City of Elk Grove. They're right now doing a conversion, and they're sticking by that 4 with the elected mayor. And I don't know if they're going to get in hot water for that. The other thing is that in redistricting, when you increase the number of elected officials, let's say you have a little Chaldean population again. You have a small Chaldean population that's 500 people. And in this scenario, that Chaldean population could be, you know, 1/5 of a district. Now let's say you go to 7 or 9 districts. And now your ideal population for district goes to 1,500. Now they're 1/3 of the district. So they, getting into more districts strengthens the voting power of small communities. So traditionally, redistricting is favored going to larger districts. Going to smaller districts dilutes their voting power. If you're that 500 in each of the 4 districts now is 3,000, then you're 1/6 of the voting power as opposed to 1/5. So the redistricting leans towards more districts, smaller districts. You know?
I hear that. Yeah, it's just the pool for candidates becomes just a little bit better. Anyway, I don't want to.
No, you should see the City of Bradbury. They have districts, and I think there's a district with like 260 people in it.
Oh my god.
Whenever I talk about total population, I'm talking about the decennial census that counts everybody, no matter what. However, we get into this kind of nuanced discussion when we talk about race and ethnicity, and that is that we switch data sets to a data set that's more updated and looks at this number that is essentially like a proxy for eligible voters. So it's citizens who are over 18. And I know there's a lot of controversy about the citizenship question on the census. The fact is that the census does ask citizenship in a study called the American Community Survey that goes to 1 out of every 6 households over a decade. And it's a long form. How long is your drive to work? And, you know, did your kids go to school? And what education level are you? And how many bedrooms are in your house? And all this, like, real long stuff. That survey is what we use to identify kind of this eligible voter population, so that when we're saying this area is 36% Latino, I'm not meaning like including the kids and the non-citizens. I'm saying 36% Latino in terms of its potential voting strength. At the other end, people might say, well, we should count Latino voters or Asian voters. But the problem with that is that in areas where you have kind of regressive Voting Rights Act, voting rights laws, you could basically incentivize cities and local governments to, you know, purge minority voters from the rolls so they wouldn't count. So we use this eligible voter population so that you're kind of nullifying the impact of unequal voter registration laws. So, long way of saying that there's 9,427 residents who are over 18 and citizens. And in terms of population, the largest is Latino. Largest is white, but the largest protected class would be Latino, with few Asians and even fewer African Americans. And this is what the city looks like. Am I right on this? Is there anything I got wrong? I don't know. Unless the city annexed something more recently, this is what the city should look like. When I look at density, there were some interesting things when I look at density. And this is, just so you understand, this is census blocks. This is the smallest unit of geography in the census. And you'll see some census blocks look literally like little blocks, like that's a little square there. And some of it like makes sense, with all these little squares, that makes sense. But this is also a census block. And this census block goes all the way down here. Now, one thing that stood out to me was that these census blocks have certain populations here that have zeros and down here that have zeros. And so I took a satellite map of the city and overlaid it to figure out what those things were. And when I looked at this one up here, it looks like this, is this all new population, new housing?
No.
It's not?
No.
I don't know why the census has zero population there, though.
We appealed it, and it was ridiculous. We appealed and said, you've missed a whole bunch of people. And they took a number from, they just moved the numbers around so that the net number was the same. They didn't have to change it.
Oh my Jesus.
It's done.
Well, that's not good.
They just made it up.
So they added it to the census block, probably. So the census block group is a larger geography, and they probably just put the more numbers in there, which screws everything up. That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
They also have this puppet. That's more business, I presume, so that might be correct?
Yeah.
There was also another little pocket you probably know of that was, like, right in here that looked like it was... this right here looks like residential. And it's at zeros, too. A lot of zeros in there.
Yeah, that was another example.
So hopefully they fix that this time.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous. I haven't seen that in other cities.
That's why our population dropped precipitously. We had the largest drop in population in the county after 2010. It went from 14,000, still on the signs going into town, I think it was 14,100 or something. We dropped to about 1,000.
So what's interesting is the state is right now doing this California Counts program, and they're going and doing their own canvassing, their own counts. And it's possible that if the census next time gets really screwed up, that the state is going to allow us to use an alternate data set, that the state would be supplanting data here. And so where you have these holes, you'd be able to say, well, the state says there's this many people here, so that's what we're going to use for redistricting. It's a lot of ifs between here and there, but that's an interesting thing. So it's good to know. The weird thing is we're going to treat that as zeros in redistricting until the new data comes out. So in 21, we'll be able to have data there. But if we were doing redistricting today, we wouldn't be able to count those people. This is what the district looks like based on that ethnic data set from the American Community Survey. Now, the census, the data comes not at that census block level. It comes at the census block group level, and the city bisects a bunch of census block groups. So where I have this 48% Latino here, that is also counting all this area out here, which probably is just unpopulated. And this 43 is counting a bunch of stuff out here and 45. So the numbers you can see are kind of drifting outside of the city, but we still will use these numbers inside the city to identify these areas. This is the Asian population. So to back up real quick, Latino population. What stands out here? There's not one that's over 50. And when there's not one census block group that's under over 50, it's really pretty impossible to have one district that's going to be over 50% Latino if its building blocks aren't 50% Latino.
It's interesting, Paul, because it's be interesting in with the 2020 census that where you have 48% there, the highest.
Yeah.
That was, remember, the area that where there was a couple of zeros. So that could
change.
Oh,
maybe, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't
it's
know.
Pretty close.
So we then have an Asian population, pretty small. I didn't do black, but it's fairly small. So there's neighborhoods in the city. That's another common building block for districting. And there's a couple different ways to get neighborhoods. One is sometimes cities will have organized neighborhood associations. I don't know, but if we do, we'll want that feedback so we can map it. Other times, cities have recognized neighborhood lines, either formally or informally. An example, City of Davis actually worked with Nextdoor, which is the third thing, to help them come up with what their lines were for that program. But there are programs like Nextdoor and Zillow that have mapped lines. And then there's also community feedback. Those community interest forms I'll mention might say, hey, my neighborhood is this area to this area, and it's called this. Like where I grew up in Glendale, we know our area is Spar Heights. And like we'll get into fights with people about where Spar Heights is. But you know, that's something that can be kind of a nice building block a lot of times for city redistricting. When we looked at that and did kind of just a little analysis, there was a website called Neighborhood Scout, which I haven't used before, that had the city identified in four populations. And I don't know how much this is going to speak to you, but this is what they essentially said are the four neighborhoods. Another site, Nextdoor, had 22 neighborhoods. So that shows a little bit of a different look. And again, they had a mapping thing, but it only allowed you to look at one neighborhood at a time, so I didn't bring the map. But this will be something where we might have a process of working with the city or figuring out, even with these vendors, how we can buy a neighborhood shapefile and or drawing it by hand or something like that. So there's some work that can be done to identify the neighborhoods, and oftentimes the conversations around redistricting are like, well, these neighborhoods go together and these neighborhoods go together.
Does Nextdoor allow for neighborhoods to overlap?
No, it doesn't. One of the things that I've provided and that we use is a real simple community of interest worksheet. I would suggest that the city has a page that they create that's dedicated for redistricting, like an email address that's dedicated for receiving input from the community. And on that page, you can post maps, you can post this presentation, you can post the community worksheet, you can receive emails from people who want to have input on redistricting, you can put up information about any workshops or anything like that. The process that we're going to be in, congratulations to my first 2021 redistricting client. But we're very, very, very early in the process. Here's today. I would consider this our first public hearing. This was an agendized public hearing. Community came, and this fulfills the obligation of the California Voting Rights Act of having a first initial hearing. A second hearing should happen really anytime. And that second public hearing would be an opportunity for us to redo this presentation. Again, make sure the public is aware that it's happening. Maybe send a notice to the newspaper.
Question, wouldn't the first public hearing require the full council to be part of that?
No. They have to be. So this is something, okay, let me back that up. I've worked with cities and school boards that treat the public hearings as any kind of public hearing. It's a public meeting, it's at the library, it has council member, it has no council members, it has all the council members. So that is one way that agencies have interpreted. I've been in other boards where the agency interpreted that they had to have a quorum. So like City of Santa Ana, they had all the, well, they didn't want to vote on the plan, so all the council members were hiding in the chambers, and they had to cancel it because they couldn't get a quorum, even though the room was packed with like 100 people. Hmm. So it is up to the interpretation of your council as to whether or not this counts as a public hearing. But I have definitely been in agencies where this would count as a public hearing, or the first public hearing.
We'll schedule it. Yeah, I'll look to Fred, but we didn't do anything to get the word out.
This is a public meeting versus what we think of as
a public hearing where we put an ad in the paper and we may really do some outreach.
So however it works out is fine. I love coming down here. I'm going to bring my bike next week, so don't worry about it.
Where did you come from?
Sacramento.
Oh.
Yeah. They have a little direct flight. It's easy now.
That's true.
I don't have to fly into Burbank anymore. So then you will have two public hearings. Then we have to kind of wait for the census data to come out. I would suggest we do these public hearings before the census data comes out. One of the reasons why is that the law actually prohibits you from drawing any maps or doing any actual redistricting work prior to the first two hearings. The idea is that those first two hearings are about listening, and they're about outreach, and they're about talking about communities of interest. They're not about like fighting over lines. So then once the census data is released, and we don't know when it'll be released, March, April of 2021. Then we can actually start drawing maps based on the community of interest and testimony. And then I would be able to provide maps 7 days before your third hearing, whenever that's going to be. That means that those maps, usually three draft maps, are publicized and they're on the website and they can be downloaded and people can come in and ready to comment on the lines. Then after that third hearing, the first one with the actual maps, then we have another period of time where we can make tweaks to maps, do different versions. And then for the fourth public hearing, as long as the maps are published 7 days before, we have the fourth public hearing and we do it again. Then there's whatever period of time before the final meeting where the adoption happens. That adoption is a up or down vote on a map that has been made public for 7 days. And what this essentially does is it prohibits an agency from doing what they've done very often in the past, which is, here's our public plan we're going to be voting on, and then they come to the meeting, and the public finds out that there's another plan that somebody drew that gets, as an amendment motion, and next thing you know, they just passed a plan that nobody's seen before, but that all the council kind of like secretly put together. So this eliminates that possibility by requiring the vote to be only on a plan that has been up for 7 days. It does allow for like small technical changes. Like let's say one of those areas with zero population, the county wants us to move the line because the way the precincts are, that's an important little tiny change, but it wouldn't allow you to make any kind of substantive changes to the plan after that adoption. The other thing that I want to mention, because it's kind of a process issue, is that, and it's my own and our company's kind of process issue, is that all communication about redistricting goes through attorneys and staff. So if a council member wants to email me and say, hey, I really want to make sure that X, Y, and Z happens, we kind of we require them to CC the city manager or, you know, somebody on staff or something like that, so that there's not kind of this outside of the process communication. It also protects us because, you know, it's not uncommon for redistricting to fall into lawsuits, and it's not very, I don't feel good going in and being subpoenaed and being having to tell, well, I had this private conversation with somebody and not being able to document it. So all communications with either the public or council members goes through designated people that are going to be on staff.
And all, Paul, is all that information, all the back and forth, the emails, questions, that sort of stuff, end up being public record?
Yeah, it's, you can PRA it, sure, yeah. Now, there have been some agencies that have tried to do portions of the redistricting process behind closed doors with, like, attorneys and putting it under attorney-client privilege. But that isn't common anymore.
I'd say that wouldn't play well here.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it. And that's basically it. We've got, I know, we're at your service in terms of how you want to pace this out and what you want to do. But, you know, really that final adoption vote isn't going to be for, you know, what is that, 18 months or something like that?
From what we talked about last time was before we get to, you know, almost any of the way I understood the conversation, any of the meetings, you know, mm-hmm. public hearings or whatever, even to talk about, special interests or whatever, communities of interest, would be to educate the public, hold meetings just to educate the public about districting, how did we get here, what's happening, why is it important to you, that kind of, do a couple of educational forums to get people knowledgeable, then we have, prior to the meetings where we say, okay, now we're going to talk about communities of interest,
yeah.
now that you have this background kind of thing. Because it's a lot to, as we just went through, it's a lot to digest in one meeting and then ask people to make decisions and articulate their community of interest when they just learned what this term is.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the way I remember the conversation.
Yeah, that's kind of what I remembered. And Lisa brought up a good point. Of course, we wanted the Spanish translations.
Yeah, the city.
So people would get that, given that we've got a fair-sized group of people.
And the new law does require that for agencies that are redistricting. The California Voting Rights Act is still what's operative for you guys, but it is required. Generally, for the most part, any agency that does translations normally should definitely be doing it for this.
So this would be, Dave, speaking to that, this would be, we would have a meeting or two that was noticed in that, or a forum for the general public to understand why we're going to redistricting, what it's all about, before we had meeting number one.
That's the way I understood it.
Yeah, that's the way I kind of remembered it going, so that the public was aware of why this was happening and what we were doing to address it.
Yeah, so oftentimes those first two meetings are kind of like the soft meetings because we don't have lines yet. They don't become. And that's when we usually see a lot of engagement and kind of like that initial like aha moments for people. There's also the possibility that you'd want to, when you get closer to the districting, to kind of insert there, well, oftentimes we'll do it after the second meeting, but before the third and before the lines are drawn, like a workshop where we bring, what we do is we do this thing where we call them placemats, but we get these laminated maps of the city that are, you know, like kind of large. And we have the populations in those census blocks or census block groups all broken out. And then people can literally sit down with a dry erase marker on these laminated maps. And they can circle their districts. And then they can do the calculations, bring calculators. And they do their calculations and they kind of come up with the districts that they want. And in Davis, we just did this. We've also done it in places like Compton, LA, and Glendale. When we do that, it allows them to kind of have this tactile on, you know, hands-on kind of experience. And it also helps them understand this really important aspect of redistricting, which is, you know, it's almost like there's that no free lunch idea. Like, you can say, this is what I want, and I want to add this over here. Well, you can't add something over here without subtracting something else over here. Like, the balancing of the districts is something that requires a lot of people to kind of, like, confront when they draw districts. So somebody might say, I want a district that's just the coast. And you're like, great, now go find another 700 people. Or you might say, great, you've got a district that's just the coast. It's 4,000 people. Now, where are you going to lose 1,400 people to make it the size of a district? And people have this kind of experience with it that is more meaningful than like hearing some nerd talk about, you know, Supreme Court decisions. So that might be another alternative as a way to kind of get better public engagement.
Isn't there software that does that as well?
There
you sit down at a computer and you...
Yeah, it is. I love software. We're actually building software right now for the 21 cycle. I love doing GIS, but it is such a steep learning curve. And we for individuals. We did that in Santa Ana. The city spent $70,000 on software for people to draw communities of interest, and two people did it.
So Santa Barbara had a huge response. They had, remember how many they had? A lot.
Santa Barbara?
The county, I know, had a huge response. I don't know the city.
So, you know, we can definitely get you vendors that will give you quotes on how much, you know, I'm doing the software. It is expensive.
We were kind of hoping that was, that you had.
Oh, no. It's a whole different special. Esri and Maptitude are the two main vendors. And they're expensive. They're six-figure kind of contracts you're doing. But in my experience, that kind of lower tech alternative just honestly works better.
Oh, cool.
Probably works fine for this size anyway.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to like the State Redistricting Commission, what they did last time is they had those programs and they had these like centers you could go into. And you'd have like somebody train you on how to do it, and you could do it. But they didn't have that. They had a lot of public input, but most of it was still written public input. And people drawing maps on things, and people circling maps, and people walking up to them with like hand-drawn things. Mm-hmm. I just feel like the barrier on, I'm a love technology, but the barrier on it can be a little bit steep. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I have some concerns that I'm not sure how this plays out and how the timing of these decisions. But we have decisions to make. For instance, right now there's 5 city council members and they rotate the mayor amongst them. There's not an elected mayor.
Yeah.
So we have not made a decision about, are we going to stay with that plan or are we going to go to 4 districts and an at-large mayor?
And when you were at the group, they were talking.
Yeah, she asked about it.
Oh, I blew it. Sorry,
no,
it was
no,
my doctor's office. I really had
no,
to
I mean, the, so...
Sorry.
Since the second time coming up, so there are some agencies that are in the 4 council members elected mayor situation, like the city of Elk Grove comes to mind. They are being sued and they're trying to keep the 4-in-1. And I've seen some agencies try to do that. I'm not sure that that's still legal under the CBRA.
That would make it easier then.
And I haven't seen anybody kind of reverse to go back to 4-in-1. One of the challenges in districting is that, let's say we have that, we're 2,500 people per district in this area, say roughly, just to make the math easier. And let's say you have a community of 500, you know, beach community of interest. They're 1/5 of the district. Now you go to 4 districts. Yeah. Now all of a sudden a district is 3,000 people. Now they're 1/6 of a district. So you're diluting their voting strength by going to bigger districts. Mm-hmm. And the inverse is true. Like, let's say you went to 10 districts, now each district would be 500 people, and that would be they'd be the entirety of one district. So the power in redistricting comes when you make districts smaller, and redistricting can dilute voting strength when you make districts larger. So when you go from 5 to 4, you might have some pushback if anybody from MALDEF or Common Cause was engaged. They'd be like, that's not the way we ever want to go. We always want to go to more seats, not less.
Okay.
The law does allow you to go to 7 or 9 council members, but I can't imagine you would want to do that.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, when and how is it decided which districts are voted on in 2022 and the other ones are 2024?
Yeah, so how many will come up in 22?
Three.
So... when you pass your final plan, and that 7 days when you have the map out, you're supposed to have, it's kind of funny, the law says that you have to have a numbering sequencing when you submit that that final map. However, people have interpreted that you have to have a numbering sequencing available on the website, but that is one of the things you can change at your last meeting, is the sequencing of the elections.
Okay.
So what you have to do is, we come up with the districts, and oftentimes in an at-large agency that's going to districts, I'll just letter them, A, B, C, D, and E. And then they need to tell me which ones are going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and which ones are going to come up in which election cycle, so that 3 come up in 22 and 2 others come up in 24. And oftentimes what they'll do is they'll try to align it to where the incumbents in that district, when their term is coming up. Now, if you have two people who are in one district, and like if you're the one who's lucky enough that the district's going to come up when you term out, as opposed to you're terming out and the district's not coming up for two more years, which advantages the other person, then that's a political decision. It's not my decision. And if the agency can't figure out the sequencing, I was in a district where they pulled the district numbers out of a hat.
Well, wait. I'm not sure I understood what you just. Okay, so if in 2020. Let's say two council members live in the same district.
Yeah.
And one of them is up and the other one just got elected in 2020.
Yeah.
So if the one that's up wins, is the one that got elected in 2020 out? They're not out.
They fulfill their term.
They get to fill their term until 2024 and then that's it.
Yeah, the way you can think of it is you've got 3 and 2.
That makes sense.
So in a weird way, in 22, 3 people are going to be elected under the districted system. And these 2 are going to hang on as legacy that they were elected citywide.
Right.
And then in 24, they're going to be under the new districted system. And so now everybody's going to be in the districted system. But it's like the Schrodinger's cat. Like, it's like you are districted, but you're also not districted. Let's say you have this 22 election, 3 people get elected in 22. Now you have 2 people who are not turned out in 24. Let's say one of those people moves to Arizona. Now you have a vacancy. The re-election, the election for that person would be citywide, because that seat is still existing in the pre-redistricting world where it was at-large elections. So you would have an at-large election to fulfill that vacancy, because that vacancy is a vacancy of all the people that voted on it in 20. So then after 24, now everybody's in the districted system and they go on peacefully.
I'm going to have to make sure no one decides to move during that time.
So City of Santa Barbara's had a situation twice now where they've had to fill a vacant spot that they're already all in districts.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't have a process. And so can we get that done up front, because they had to develop it as a kind of on the fly?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
So I'm not an expert in the municipal law side and how that part works, but generally, if there's a vacancy, or if, let's say, you create a district and nobody runs, and so nobody files and it's just vacant, you would then appoint for that vacancy. But you would appoint for the vacancy as the boundaries were when that vacancy was created, so if somebody liked the at-large election system. And so that should be kind of operative at the city level. I don't know what Santa Barbara's problem was, unless they had gone to districts and they tried. I know it's like, and there was a city in San Bernardino County that went to districts, and then they had an election. They called an election for one of the replacements of the members, and they were only allowing people in the district to vote. And I had to call the county. I was like, by the way, it's at large. And so they had this whole thing where they like had put together an election they had to nullify.
Oops.
And then redo, because they had mistakenly thought that the district lines like took effect everywhere equally at the same time. They don't. They take effect over a two-step process.
I got you.
So I don't know what Santa Barbara's fault was.
Oh, I think it's just because the way they had written it was that their city council members will be elected by the people in those districts. Well, when you have an appointment, then they're not being elected. And so the people were like, wait a minute, we didn't get to vote on this. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there was a little hiccup.
There's sometimes hiccups.
And I would like to avoid that here. We'll learn from everybody else. We don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
That works for me. I'm good.
Gabby?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions?
No.
This
is great.
I get it. It looks like it's on us, Dave.
This is great.
The next
really
thing for
good.
Us to work on, Paul, is kind of a schedule working backwards from election to the formal steps and then the informal.
Yeah. If you want to use, so that new law that was passed actually set some dates for cities that are doing redistricting, and you could kind of piggyback on those. But I would think the easiest thing for you to do is to think of that kind of March, April is when the census data is coming out. put two meetings before that, the other two meetings after that, and then your final meeting for adoption. So you could kind of like figure out something that straddles kind of a likely March or April, and maybe schedule it for like a March, that third meeting, and start, use that as your March 21 is like your kind of medium point. And then if we have to move that back a month because the census data hasn't come out or something, we can. But at least we'll be in a position to be ready to move when mm-hmm. the data does come out. You don't want to be in a situation where you're putting it too far out, which obviously you guys aren't, but just because it's going to be so jammed. I mean, by the time I hit July in 21, I'm going to be doing all these from Skype. I'm not going to be able to do anything in person. Mm. There's going to be hundreds of districts being doing redistricting.
There's nothing that prohibits the council, for example, you know, when you were thinking about Measure X and you went around in groups and talked to smaller groups to educate them. That could be done.
Of course, right? Yeah. Those are outreach meetings, sure.
Even these.
The other thing we talked about on the phone was when we first talked about me potentially coming down here is you can also reach out kind of the grass tops idea to go to people and organizations that you know are active in the community and just, you know, send them an email and call somebody and ask them to come. You know, that kind of stuff can be useful. I know in the county there's a number of different kind of social justice and community outreach organizations. Mm.
So the meetings 1 and 2, those should probably be sometime not before March 21st and 21, but they should be maybe one of them in the year 21 or...
I mean, you could straddle, you could do one in, you know, December 1st, 2020, and the other one January, February, 2021, and then do the... Now, one thing you just to acknowledge, the CVRA does kind of, if you're being sued, which I don't think you are, if you're being sued, it would start this 90-day clock. But there's also this weird situation we're going to be in pretty soon where it's not going to make sense to do redistricting in 90 days because everybody's going to be waiting for the data to come out. So, you know, I think you're going to have a pretty liberal kind of freedom to handle the time situation. But yeah, if you're gonna do your first two hearings, one fall of 2020, one, you know, beginning of the year 21, and then just kind of hang out and wait for the data to come out and wait for me to be able to say that I can draw maps, then as soon as I can draw maps, you'll have then, you know, 7 days later with or some period after that, make your third meeting.
So that would give us in the city about a year to get out to the
talk
community
to people and, yeah.
And get them aware that this is coming and to understand it.
Yeah. And I'm more than happy to help you with materials, and the Community of Interest worksheet is a good tool. You know, maybe help you with like a real simple PowerPoint that somebody could give. I'd be able to come down. I don't remember what we put in the contract, but we have some set number of meetings that I can come down to, but I can also provide you with tools so that you can do some outreach too.
Yeah, I like the idea of maybe you coming, spending your time on the two big meetings, the formal public hearings prior to census material, March 2021 being available. The little grassroots thing, I'd made the same note of kind of a, you know, a 15-minute presentation that would be suitable for a Rotary Club or other small groups.
Another nice thing to do potentially is if we come up with some like nice maps of the neighborhoods and a map of the city, you know, I've seen cities and they've gone to like the farmers markets, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and they just have a table. And they have the maps, and they have those forms, and they say the city's going to be drawing districts, you know, do you have any input? You know.
Yeah, that's a good way
that's
to do
the
that.
Kind of thing, yeah. potentially.
Yeah. Just do tabling, yeah.
Yeah.
Are your materials bilingual?
No, usually the cities will do the translations. I can hire translators, but it's not in the contract.
Okay. Any other?
Appreciate it.
No,
appreciate
great.
Your time.
Yeah,
awesome.
Happy to be here. I wouldn't be happy if it was raining, but it's beautiful outside.
We make this
kind of
weather.
I know you do. You should export more of it to Sacramento.
So, Paul, you're Upper Spar. I think I grew up in Glendale.
Oh, did you really?
Yes, I'm Glen Oaks Canyon.
Oh, you are? That's crazy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I grew up right below Montrose, 1 street below Montrose.
Okay.
Where'd you go to school?
Glendale.
Oh, that's fine. My brother went to Glendale for a little while. I went to CV.
Okay.
Yeah. But Glendale is, I love talking about Glendale as a redistricting thing, because Glendale has this, like, almost everything you can imagine in redistricting. They've got this really kind of hillside community area. They've got this Latino population south of the freeway. They have a kind of an urban area. They've got this Armenian population that kind of mixes it all up. There's racially polarized voting in Glendale, but it's weird because it'll be like the Armenians will vote against the Latinos and the whites will vote against the Armenians, but the Latinos will vote if it's like an Armenian versus a white, they'll vote for the Armenians. Because it's like they're voting not based on their race, but they're voting on, like, these are people that are from south of the freeway, these are people from a more urban area, so I'll vote for that candidate over the person who lives up in the hillsides or up in Verdugo and kind of these nicer areas, so it's fun.
So what's the actual makeup of the city council right now?
All Armenian.
Serious?
Yeah. And there was actually a lawsuit somebody filed that said that... So there's interesting... So there's a couple of things. Well, there was a school board member there might be one Latino, but I don't think so. There was a school board member who filed a lawsuit that was thrown out. It was one of the very few CVRA lawsuits ever thrown out. But he claimed that it was a violation of the Voting Rights Act because white people couldn't get elected.
Aww.
And one of the things that was weird about it, yeah, I know. So one of the things that was weird about it too is that the Armenian composition of the city council is chiefly driven from the fact that Armenians vote in low turnout special elections and small elections. And the city council in Glendale always had their elections in April of the even numbered year. So the only people who would turn out would be the Armenian population because they were all active. And Latinos wouldn't turn out. Even at some point, white voters were kind of like, eh, forget about it. Now they're moving all elections in California to be concurrent with the statewide elections. So the Glendale elections are probably going to change now that everybody's going to be voting these elections and more likely to get a Latino elected.
Interesting.
But I think it's all Armenian right now.
And the Glendale fire chief is now our fire chief.
Not the one that lit the fires. You're familiar with that story, right?
Oh, he left that off of his resume.
There was a Glendale fire chief in the 80s.
I don't think he was the chief. He was the fire marshal.
Maybe.
Oh, great.
He was lighting fires.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those fires.
Or was his last name.
That sounds totally right, yeah.
That's funny. No, not that one.
Not that one.
The most pretty set
one. It's good to know. I'm sure he's enjoying it up here.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The big thing seen for Glendale transplants. I'm going to have to think about it. All right. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have to. Remember to CC staff.
I will.
Thanks, Gail. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, are we doing more on this agenda? Or no?
We can talk about.
Cool. I feel good. Very attorney like. Every time I'd say something almost lawyerly, I kind of look at you like.
You guys want to talk?
So you're outside counseling
the next meeting.
Okay, cool.
Here.
Is there anything that you'll have
to do? Is schedule an update for the city council.
Yeah, I think.
I try to not answer.
Oh, the next meeting. We were talking about. Starting out before we had one more meeting, scheduling an update for the city council so that they all understand what's going on. And I don't know, when could we, well, you just asked me.
Yeah, I'll look at
you. Okay,
and then once we do that, then we can decide from there when the ad hoc.
Yeah, I mean, like, right.
Gail, I'll see you tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, what's happening?
Well, I'll be there. Every one of
you. You're in your setup.
Do you have a sense of what the outline of the
meeting is?